This is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU, I'm Michael Monks. Are you a fan of Airbnb when you travel? If so, you're not alone. The short-term rental website is wildly popular with consumers and owners, but it gets mixed reviews from local governments in our area. Coming up, we'll take a look at the issues affecting policymakers' decisions in a wide-ranging roundtable discussion. But first, April is National Child Abuse Prevention Month. Do you know the warning signs? Last year, more than 60,000 phone calls and more than 9,000 direct reports of disclosures or concerns around abuse and neglect were reported to 241 Kids, Hamilton County's child abuse hotline. Let's talk about why and what can be done. Joining Cincinnati Edition in the studio today are Mayerson Center for Safe and Healthy Children Clinical Fellow, Dr. Prathima Schanbog. Welcome, Prathima. And Mayerson Center social worker, Andrea Ritchie. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join in on this conversation, it's 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to weave some of those into the show today. So the 2019 Abuse Prevention Resource Guide tells us that across the nation, in fiscal year 2017, an estimated 674,000 children were found to be victims of child abuse or neglect. 75% were victims of neglect, and more than 18% were physically abused. About 10% were sexually abused. That's national. What do the stats tell us about the local situation?
I would say that the stats locally are fairly consistent with what we're seeing. We at the Mayerson Center, the majority of the kids we tend to see, the concerns are around sexual abuse. But certainly we see kids who have been physically abused, kids who have witnessed some type of violent crime or event. And across the hospital through our emergency room, we see lots of different cases of all different types of concerns of abuse and neglect.
So that may be an abuse case as well. If a child witnesses some type of act of violence that's committed by adults upon other adults?
Absolutely. Yeah. So if a child witnesses domestic violence, that is something that is reportable to Children's Services. Sometimes children may witness violence against a sibling or someone else in their family. And so that's something we would talk to them about to just try to get some more information.
Are we seeing an improvement or are the abuse numbers increasing year over year?
You know, I think the numbers you had mentioned, the national statistics, have been on pretty much the same rates for a couple of years. So that number of over 600,000 children being substantiated victims of child abuse and neglect has been the same, along with the number of children that have unfortunately passed away from child abuse and neglect, a little bit over 1,500 children a year.
So is that a statement that the system needs to update its approach to fixing this, or are there societal problems that can't seem to be fixed? Why are the numbers flat?
That's a great question. I think so. Some of it is, you know, with statistics, we never quite know how information is gathered and what questions are asked to get some of those statistics. I think some of it, too, could be, if we flip it a little, there could be an increase in reporting, which perhaps means an increase in awareness and an increase in people getting more involved and feeling more engaged in the process and being willing to report their concerns of abuse and neglect. So that's not necessarily a bad thing, but certainly it's concerning how much abuse goes on day in and day out. I mean, statistically speaking, there's a report of abuse every 10 seconds nationwide.
What does it mean for a child to be neglected?
I think typically neglect covers lack of basic needs being met. So whether there's food insecurity, housing insecurity, educational neglect, medical neglect, there's lots of different avenues that neglect can cover, which I think causes it to be kind of that broader bucket in the statistical range.
So what type of harm is inflicted upon a child who is suffering from neglect? What are some of the symptoms that people might see from someone who is neglected?
So there's a variety. So as Andrea said, it depends on the type of neglect. Medical neglect is something that we can get involved in the Mayerson Center, looking at children who may not have their medical needs met. So whether that's medications not being filled, For example, if they have diabetes, there's a high risk of them being admitted to the hospital for medical complications. Of course, there's other types of neglect as well. So if a child's living in an environment that, like Andrea said, their basic needs aren't being met, whether that's food insecurity, housing insecurity, et cetera.
When we talk about the number of kids who suffer physical or sexual abuse, is there any data on who most often are the perpetrators?
Sure. When we think about sexual abuse, we know that for child sexual abuse, it's estimated that about 90% of children who are sexually abused know their perpetrator. So either the child knows the perpetrator or the family.
So this is somebody that's close to the child usually.
Correct.
So if people suspect that there's neglect going on or that some child is being abused, what should they do?
Certainly anyone that has a concern or a suspicion around abuse or neglect going on, they should contact their local children's services agency. I mean, I think sometimes people worry about what's going to happen if they make a phone call, and people worry that they're going to create this big kind of chaotic explosion to happen. But really, it's helpful for people to have information. You might have a small piece of information, but maybe seven other people have called in with similar concerns around this child or family. And so it helps paint that bigger picture, and it helps people understand what exactly is going on. And really the goal is safety of that child or children in that home. And so we want to kind of find out what's going on to make sure their needs are being met, or that if there's bigger abusive issues going on, that those can be addressed and we can keep those kids safe.
So I know you all work at the Mayerson Center based at Children's Hospital, so you're not necessarily answering the 241 Kids hotline, but they do frequently refer to you if medical attention or some type of social work advocacy is required. Can you tell us what happens when someone calls 241 Kids? What are the questions like? What type of feedback is the caller getting?
Sure. So typically, people want to information they have around the family, names, ages, ability to locate the family, and then just kind of what the caller knows. So any information they have that's going to be helpful for those on the hotline to determine where to go from there is what they're going to want to know. They may want to know, you know, any dangerous things around the home, weapons in the home, animals in the home, those kind of things, but really just basic information. And people can make anonymous calls. They don't have to leave their personal information when they do make these phone calls.
And you had touched on that briefly, is that some people may have some concern about themselves when they make these types of calls. Does this prompt some sort of investigation into who they are or what their role is? Is there a way to address that concern in the marketing or the campaigns that go out there about the resources available to people who want to identify abuse? Or are there information sites or materials available so that people can be better prepared to report?
I mean, Children's Services, Hamilton County Jobs and Family Services has their own website. And so a lot of those questions can certainly be answered around people wanting to know what that experience is like when they make a report. I think, you know, it's just more encouraging people to get involved and really to know that it's okay. I mean, we all really need to work together to keep kids safe and not, in recognizing that it's okay to do that. You know, people are very quick to jump to report concerns around animal abuse or things going on with animals. And so we hope that it will continue that trend with children as well and feeling comfortable and safe to do that.
Prathima, what happens when a victim of child abuse or neglect then comes to Children's Hospital or the Mayerson Center?
Sure. So if we use the example of sexual abuse, because like Andrea said, in an outpatient setting at the Mayerson Center, we are most often working with children and families who have been victims of sexual abuse. So let's say the report has been made to Child Protective Services and law enforcement has also been made aware. We like to schedule the child for a forensic interview, and that is essentially a neutral fact-finding interview that is recorded. And law enforcement and Child Protective Services can also be present and observe the interview in real time. The child's given the opportunity during the interview to disclose and tell us their story about what has happened, and it's also an opportunity for us to evaluate their safety. And after that interview, we meet with the child and the family, and we offer every child a medical evaluation as well. And we like to give them as many options as possible, medically, as well as providing them referrals for therapy, for trauma-informed evidence-based therapy.
What's the typical experience for a child who comes in? Is there a reluctance to participate? Is there fear, or do they tend to be more open to sharing?
You know, I observe the forensic interviews often, and Andre is one of our forensic interviewers. And I will say that in my experience, when I watch them, they go through a rapport-building phase during their interview. And it is really humbling to watch these children build a rapport with our interviewers and then feel comfortable and safe enough to tell us their story.
Andrea, what type of questions are directed at the child who comes in?
So typically, it's a really open kind of a question. We want the child to use their own words to share their experience. It's not a leading interview. We're not there to put words in their mouth, but we're really there to provide an opportunity for them to share and give us information and details around what they've experienced.
And they tend to be open to these questions once the rapport is established, that they tend to be helpful?
Oh, absolutely. It's like Prathima said, it's very humbling, the amount of children that are willing to come in and talk and share and give us information about an experience that they had. I think for a lot of kids, the anticipation is kind of worse than actually coming in and talking and sharing. And I think it can be very empowering to feel that they are being heard and believed and acknowledged for what they experienced.
Is there a sense among those kids that they know that something bad happened to them, something wrong?
I think they know that something happened that wasn't okay with them, something that happened that, you know, that they weren't okay with and that they wanted to share and tell someone else about.
What about any fear of getting someone in trouble? If there could be criminal charges coming against mom or dad or a caregiver, how do you help alleviate that concern upon a child?
I think that's certainly a big barrier to kids disclosing in general. I think what's really difficult is a lot of kids don't disclose their experience immediately. A lot of kids, it's days, weeks, months, years before they're feeling comfortable to tell. And I think that's one of the barriers, is taking some responsibility and worrying about getting others in trouble or worrying about what others are going to think or worried about how it's going to change the family dynamic. Some kids get very direct threats and, you know, they take that to heart. So kind of getting through that can be a challenge at some times, but a lot of kids really do an amazing job in the interview.
We'll continue our conversation about Child Abuse Prevention Month in just a moment. That discussion is coming up, too. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Last year, nearly 24 infants and toddlers were reported to Hamilton County as having been shaken. 4 of them died. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Do you know the signs? Do you know what to do next? Joining Cincinnati Edition in the studio today are Mayerson's Center for Safe and Healthy Children Clinical Fellow, Dr. Prathima Schonbog, and Mayerson Center social worker Andrea Ritchie. If you have questions or comments, give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Let's talk about that stat that I just offered, the abuse of the infants. We hear about shaken babies on the news somewhat regularly. What does that mean to have a shaken baby? What exactly is happening in that situation?
Sure. So the term shaken baby is heavily used. I think these days we like to use the term abusive head trauma.
Okay.
It kind of allows us the opportunity to just really define it as child abuse. So a child that suffers from abusive head trauma can present with a variety of symptoms, from being a fussy baby, having difficulty feeding that child, all the way to a child who is comatose, having seizures, et cetera. And it is fatal, as you had mentioned. Our rates of 20% of case fatality is pretty standard across the country.
Do these cases tend to emerge from instances of parents who are frustrated, or is there more of an intent to abuse a child on behalf of the perpetrators?
You know, I try to not think about the why, but I will say that we know that in these cases, they peak around age 3 months, 4 months, when a child is crying more often. And a care provider can become very frustrated with that, and in a moment get very frustrated with their child and shake them.
Let's talk about sexual abuse, something that kids are subjected to. What is the experience like for a child who has experienced this before really even understanding what sexual acts may be? When a child is referred to Meyerson after experiencing this type of trauma, what's the first bit of interaction that takes place?
So again, typically when kids come to our center, the first thing we do is the forensic interview. We interview kids from the ages 3 and up. And so it's just, again, it's kind of a safety conversation. So we build rapport with them. We ask them to tell us why they're, what they know about coming to see us. And we just try to ask open questions and talk about safety often. So that's often how we get to the topic of concern, talking about safety, maybe more specifically body safety, and moving from there. So again, most kids are okay about talking, and they may have some fears or concerns, but typically they will engage in the process and they're able to answer questions.
Is there any difference in the level at which these children are willing to participate or show a level of understanding if they're in there for physical abuse as opposed to sexual abuse? Are there differences in the way that the child may interact?
Not in my experience. Again, I would say the majority of the kids we do the forensic piece with are kids who have been sexually abused. I think very often, because of very common delays in disclosure, we rely pretty heavily on their ability to talk and share and provide information. In a physical abuse situation, it may be obvious upon physical exam that something has happened. Whereas with a child who's been sexually abused, that medical piece may not be so obvious.
What are the signs that the public can be on the lookout for if they are suspecting that a child may have been subjected to some form of abuse?
So a change in a child's behavior can certainly be one. So a child that no longer wants to attend school or is attending school and performing poorly, behavior changes in the home, should they be, you know, scared of certain individuals, scared of certain situations.
The Meyerson Center for Safe and Healthy Children is based at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. We've talked a little bit about how you act when a child who may be the victim of abuse comes in to talk about it. Just give us an overview of the what and why about your organization in particular.
So child advocacy centers were established in the early 80s, and the thought was it was very beneficial to children and families to have a centrally located place where they can talk, come and get a lot of their needs met. So back in the day, kids might have to tell their story 7, 8, 9, 10 times to all different people. So the thought of having one place where they can come, talk to someone, give that information, have their medical needs met, have their therapeutic needs met, have the ability to meet with children's services and law enforcement and whoever else may be involved was just much easier for families, much more trauma-informed and trauma-focused type of approach. And we want to try to make this as easy and less stressful as we possibly can for families in this situation.
Is there training available for child caretakers or family members who want to create safe environments for children?
Oh, yes, there's lots of different trainings. a lot of organizations require that, you know, educators and daycare providers receive some type of child abuse training. There's an organization called Darkness to Light, which provides a great training on child sexual abuse, which I facilitate, and there's lots of facilitators around that can provide that training. But I think it's, again, really important for people to have some exposure, have some understanding, and have some tools to recognize, respond, and react to abuse.
If parents want to educate themselves a little bit more about keeping their children safe, they can visit websites like the American Academy of Pediatrics and healthychildren.org.
So what if there's a parent or a caregiver who has been abusive and has faced consequences for that, but remains as a legal guardian of the child? Is there a way for that person to overcome their abusive ways? Is there training for that aspect of this?
That's a great question. I think a lot of times if a child is removed from their home, there are some mandates upon that parent or guardian or caregiver to go through different types of educational trainings, perhaps get some therapy for themselves to hope and ensure that the child will go back to a safer environment.
Is there any data available on the type of kids that may be most susceptible to abuse, economic situation, geography, or is it widespread?
So it's important, you know, there are certainly some risk factors, but I think it's important that people know that abuse can affect any family, regardless of race, religion, socioeconomic status. And knowing that help and being aware of that can help us help children be more safe.
Where do you see the community as a whole can improve in ways that it works together with each other to prevent abusive situations for children or to react to abuse cases?
I think, again, people being open to the idea that abuse does occur, being more mindful about having safety conversations with their children, educating their children on body safety, using terminology that the general public would understand. People often give nicknames to their private parts, and then other people may not know what they're talking about if they're talking about a certain part of their body. And just being open to talking about it and fostering that sense of it's okay to talk about things that are maybe hard to talk about.
So immigration is a national topic right now, and I'm wondering if you're seeing any instances of this locally where there may be situations facing immigrants that make their families more vulnerable to abusive situations, such as stress of income or housing or food insecurity. Are there immigrant cases locally where abuse allegations are being investigated by people who are relatively new to the country?
I don't know specific data on that. We certainly see families where English is not their first language and where there may be stressors. But I think, again, just to echo, abuse hits all levels of our nation, and it doesn't really manifest in a certain population or person.
These kids who suffer any kind of abuse will grow up to be adults. And what are the long-term ramifications of the abuse suffered as a child once one enters adulthood?
Sure. So you can classify abuse as an adverse childhood experience. And we know, and there's data that shows that children that have suffered through an adverse childhood experience are more likely to have chronic health outcomes. So whether that's COPD or drug abuse, depression, there's plenty of data out there about adverse childhood experiences. But there's also data out there showing that if a child has a supporting caregiver in their life, that their outcome is likely to be much better.
April is National Child Abuse Prevention Month. We'll have information that was provided in this interview online at wvxu.org. Thank you to Dr. Prathima Schanbag and Andrea Ritchie, a social worker from the Mayerson Center for Safe and Healthy Children, for talking with us today. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
You You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.